For this evening's talk, I'd like to continue talking about some of the topics that were raised by the radio interviews. They asked me about greed, hatred, and delusion. So I might give a talk this evening about greed, hatred, and delusion. Especially since these are such not only fundamental teachings in Buddhism and such fundamental forces in our mind, but also such critical and dangerous forces in the world. Greed, hatred, and delusion. Our good friends, close allies. In Buddhism, we don't really take so seriously the notion that we can externalize and objectify the evil and the bad in the world, even though we have like Mara is a figure of the tempter, but Mara is always a bit more of a trickster or a jokester rather than being a kind of malevolent source of all evil. But the real sources of problems lie within, and within the greed, hatred, and delusion. So the first thing that teaching does, when we hear that, if we hear that suffering arises from greed, hatred, and delusion, the first thing that it does is it's a very empowering teaching, because it says basically everybody is the same. And everybody's facing exactly the same problems and the same challenges. And no matter whether you're the President of the United States or you're an untouchable living in the gutter in India, you still have greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's a great leveller of humanity. Of course, it doesn't mean we've got greed, hatred, and delusion to the same amount. We've all got different quantities of it, and the qualities, the details of it are different for everyone, and they're different for the same person at different times. The basic mechanism of them is still the same. Now, these things, greed, hatred, and delusion, of course, are interdependent. And they are, in reality and in life, they're always mixed up. We can kind of analyze them out for the purposes of talking about them. But when they appear, they always appear wrapped up inside one another. And if you peel off a layer of greed, then pretty quickly you'll find some anger in there. And if you peel back the anger, you'll pretty quickly find some delusion, and you peel back the delusion and you'll find more greed inside that. They're interdependent and they're always conditioning each other. So that the more greed we have, the more anger we tend to have. And I think we've all experienced that when we don't have any greed, we tend to be very contented and easily satisfied and so on. And then when we're used to getting what we want, the more we get what we want, the more we expect to be able to get what we want, and then the more angry and frustrated we are when we don't get what we want. And so there's some of the things that are very useful for teaching us that is things like computers, traffic, community decision-making processes. These are some of the great teachers in our life, which we have to be very grateful for. This is how the great bodhisattvas will manifest to us, okay, in the form of a recalcitrant operating system, or in the form of a person who just won't do what we want. So somehow we think that we're going to be happy when we get what we want, and in a sense we are. So the happiness and reward system, it actually does work. You do actually get pleasure from sensual pleasures. Right? It's not that they're not pleasurable, but it doesn't give you quite the satisfaction that they promise and quite what you expect. And so this is really the problem there. The try and get it, the more you anticipate, the more you need the next time. The more expectation you have, the harder you are to satisfy. And the more frustrated and annoyed and angry you are that you don't get what you want, or if it's not perfect. And underlying the whole process is the process of delusion, the delusion that somehow this time it's going to make a difference. Somehow this time, if I can get what I want, then I'll be happy, I'll be satisfied. I just need this gadget, or to accomplish this task, or to persuade this person, or to get this kind of food. Just this one, and then somehow you'll be happy. And of course the reality is that happiness has very little to do with any of these kinds of things. And not to speak of spiritual practitioners, but even for anyone, for ordinary people, the majority, the vast bulk of the happiness that we have in the world comes from, in the material plane, it's just the simple satisfaction of basic needs, to have enough food to eat, a roof over our heads, and so on. And on an emotional level, to have good relationships, to have friends, to have family, and have good connections with them. These are really the things that make a difference in terms of happiness. everything else is just the icing on the cake. So one of the things that greed, hatred and delusion do is that they're very good friends of each other, and they will always try to support and help and prop up each other. And when the mind is seized with greed or seized with anger, then it doesn't want to look at itself. So this is something that's very, in a practical sense, is very important to appreciate. That when we feel angry, we don't want to look at that. We don't want to admit it. You want to go into denial of it. When you feel very greedy and you want something, you want someone, then the mind is always focused outwards to that thing and doesn't want to reflect back, doesn't want to ask those questions. And so this is where you have this kind of the nimbus, or the halo around those things that we want. We can't see the drawbacks in them. There might be a person that we're in love with, or it might be a car that we like, or some kind of gadget that we want, or whatever. We can only look at the good side of it. We don't want to be reminded of it. We don't want to be told how much cholesterol is in that slice of cake. That'll take the pleasure out of it. So greed kind of keeps on going, but greed kind of works in the mind in subtle ways that they kind of use delusion as a cloak. For example, and this example was given by Lumpur Paniwada when we saw him in Bantat in Thailand about many years ago, and he said, you know, it's just, you kind of, the way it works is you sort of walk along the street and you see a television set in the window of a shop, and you look at you look at that and you don't even think very much of it. You just sort of glance at it as you go past and so on, and then you sort of keep on walking, and then later on the thought occurs to you, oh, that's quite a nice TV set, wasn't it? And then you sort of go home, and you know, evening time comes and you switch the news on and watching the telly, and then you're thinking, oh, the screen's not so good, you know, the picture resolution's not great, that other one I saw in the shop today, that looked like quite a nice one, didn't it? It would be a lot better. And so the mind sort of starts thinking and thinking about it, but it'll think about it for a bit and then sort of subside. And that's the cloak of delusion. And so the cloak of delusion will hide it, but the kind of the processes are going on subliminally, and sort of gradually the mind sort of latches onto it until eventually you decide to go and get it. So this is the way that greed works, and anger of course works in a similar kind of way. And just as with greed, that one is always focusing on the positive side of things and the attractive side of them, and particularly the gratifying side of things, how things can make you feel good. But hatred or anger is always focusing on the negative side, about always thinking about how that other thing is harmful or is going to make you feel bad. wanting to push it away, wanting to get rid of it. So there are a number of different important strategies and means that we can and that we should use to deal with these things. The first step is simply to realize them, to actually understand as you're sitting here listening and reflecting in oneself, and to look at these processes. These are things which the Buddha talked about again and again and again, not just once or twice, and so you can file it away for future reference. But he kept on bringing it up, kept on reminding people, keep on looking inside, because that's what greed, hatred and delusion do. It's not that you realize, oh yes, greed, hatred and delusion, they're no good, and then somehow they don't come back again. They keep on coming again and again and again. So we have to keep on reminding ourselves again and again and again. So this is like the first level of what we're doing, is just the realization, getting the concept across, getting the idea that these things are important, and realizing that if we're going to be blaming all our troubles on external forces, then we're not going to live a very happy life. Having said which, it's still important that we don't, I think it's important that we don't reify this. It's also vital that we acknowledge the importance and significance of the external world. And I think it's wrong to use these kinds of Buddhist ideas to then cut ourselves off from and deny the importance of the external world. It's only worldly dhammas and so on. We have to be actively involved within our society, our social structure, and the environment, both the human environment and the natural environment, because these things are also part of our life, and they're also fields within which greed, hatred and delusion operate, and in which they bring great harm and suffering if they're allowed to go unchecked. So one of the problems that we're having these days is we have the problems with the climate change and so on, and people trying to, you see, different kinds of responses to it. One kind of response is to say, well, we can convince everybody that actually you can make more money by investing in green industries. Carbon intensive industries are the past and you're going to lose money, and so if you want to make more money, do that by investing in green industries. And of course that's really just using that greed to motivate people further. But then there's like a higher spiritual take on it, which is that greed itself is the problem. And so we shouldn't just be looking to replace one industry with another, but we should be looking at a way of living where economic and material prosperity and well-being doesn't define our life and doesn't define the meaning of what we do and how we choose to live our life. And so this is more of a spiritual response to climate change rather than an economic response to it. But of course the enabler of all of these things is delusion, we call moha. And it's important to know that delusion is an active force in the mind. And it was when I listened to a talk by Bhanteji a number of years ago, he made, I think, quite an interesting suggestion that we should distinguish between delusion as moha and ignorance as avijja, in the sense that delusion we can think of as like an arisen or an active force that confuses the mind and obstructs the vision of truth, whereas avijja is much more subtle and much more of an underlying or fundamental lack of knowledge of the truth, and especially the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. So avijja is in a sense much more profound and much more existential, whereas moha, delusion, is more like the psychological arisen capacity in the mind. That's not necessarily a defensible doctrinal position in terms of being able to clearly distinguish between these terms in the way that they're used in the Pali text, but it is, I think, a useful practical distinction to make. So a delusion or moha is the force that kicks into play when the mind wants to hide bits of the truth from itself. And I'm sure we all know that when our mind is consumed by greed or anger, that it becomes very uncomfortable to live inside ourselves. It becomes very uncomfortable to focus inside your body and to realize actually what is going on. But this is an essential part of the practice. I mentioned before that one aspect of undoing greed, hatred and delusion is simply getting the right idea. It's like the right view aspect is what we're doing here. And another aspect is, in a sense, the cognitive training aspect, is turning our mind away from thoughts of greed, hatred and delusion and turning our mind towards thoughts of non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. So it's like Samasankhapa, the Noble Eightfold Path. So there's those two factors, but then also is very important is the mindfulness factor. It's going to be aware of how greed, hatred and delusion actually arise and how they're embodied in our mind. And when I was just doing this interview, one of the people said we should try to be conscious livers. Right? So we try to live a conscious life, but then it became, well, we should be a conscious liver. You're saying, like, not a liver as in your stomach liver. I said, yes, exactly, a liver as in your stomach liver. That's exactly what you need to do, is you make your liver conscious. Because it's in your liver and your spleen and your gut and your intestines that all of these emotions get cooked up and get held. And that's not a kind of a mystical doctrine at all, but that's something, it's very measurable. You can look at the different kinds of chemicals and so on that are getting processed through those organs. And somebody who's got a lot of anger, it really does affect those things. Someone who has a lot of greed, it really does affect those things. So we have conscious livers, have a conscious spleen, a conscious small intestine. Very, very important. We bring consciousness to those things, and that's what we do when we're meditating and we bring awareness inside the body. And so this is one of the reasons why all good meditation systems are very body focused, whether that be in terms of awareness of the breath or awareness of feelings in the body or parts of the body or whatever. There's always that sense of groundedness between in the reality that we're experiencing here and now. I'm personally very suspicious of visualization meditations and other kinds of meditations that take you too far outside of the body into some kind of abstract realm of the imagination. I'm not convinced that this is a really advisable way to go in terms of meditation. Certainly these kinds of things are not found within early Buddhist meditation. There is an element of visualization which is involved, but it's always visualization of the body most prominently. And so it's always keeping it into the here and now, using imagination to get closer to reality and not to build up a fantasy world. This is one of the more subtle and more powerful levels of investigation into greed, hatred and delusion, is watching how these things are actually brought up and held in different parts of the body. But even that is important, but even that is not the most profound level. Because greed, hatred and delusion ultimately are, of course, primarily mental forces, mental factors. They affect the body, and we get access to them and understand them through experiencing the body, but at the end of the day they're actually mental forces, mental factors. And when the mind is very clear and awareness is very strong, then we can see these things emerging. You know, almost we start to be able to see them almost in their true nature, that they come out like some kind of beast that emerges from the swamp. We can feel the force of those things actually happening, manifesting in the present moment. And when you actually penetrate through and see them very clearly and without flinching, and this is something I notice a lot in my own meditation, that if the mind is not equanimous and clear enough, and it flinches when these things happen. There'll be like a level of insight where it'll open up, like a motivation or a movement of the mind will open up, and you'll see the defilements in there. And the mind flinches, it draws back, it doesn't want to see. There's not enough steadiness and equanimity in the mind. But when that is there, the steadiness and equanimity, and you can watch. And these things are actually become quite bizarre, because they're almost alien. It's almost like you have this thing. I'm thinking of the movie Alien now, the kind of this thing living in your guts, which doesn't actually belong there, and it sort of just bursts out. That's what happened. I'm sure you remember in the movie The Alien, about the dinner table scene, and the that's what happens every time when we're sitting eating lunch, doesn't it? You're sitting there, supposedly like a civilized human being, and this kind of force of greed erupts to do that. See, it's interesting if you can consider like table manners and etiquette, you know. It's kind of curious why we tend to be so fussy about table manners. You know, you've got to put the knife and the fork in the right way, and, you know, the spoon's got to be on the left of the fork, and all of these kinds of things. And the way that you fold the napkins and all of these, there's all this kind of incredibly complex etiquette about eating. And you find that in every society, that there are a lot of different rules and etiquette around eating. But this is, of course, one of the great reasons why that's the case, is because if we just let our instincts go untrammeled, well, then it becomes all a fairly uncivilized affair. And so that's when we need to sort of bind it up and to hold it within a bunch of rules and conventions that can restrain that greed and turn it into a, at least on the veneer of it, is civilized. Of course, the reality of the act itself is still desperately uncivilized. You know, you've still got these organic matter which you're rending and pounding with your teeth, and you're taking something from the outside world, breaching that fundamental layer of separation which we make between self and other. And you're taking this food and you're taking it which is other and making it into self, bringing it through that boundary which we're normally very, very finicky about, and assimilating that, and of course later on then excreting it. So it's sort of going through this whole process. And so that process itself is bestial, even beneath bestial. It's something which is done by even single-celled organisms will still do fundamentally the same thing, the process of assimilation and excretion. So this is why we have to sort of wrap that up with as many conventions as possible to give it a veneer of civilization. Actually, what's happening is these alien beasties are emerging from our guts. And so this is why it's important to spend that time of reflection to understand what's going on when we're eating food. And you also notice that point is also very interesting, because then you see the how quickly the greed turns to anger and hatred or aversion when the thing doesn't taste as much as good as you wanted, or when food has that very funny quality. When it's not quite right, it actually becomes really repulsive. The line between delicious food and repulsive food is very hard to define easily, and in part is socially conditioned. I remember in Northeast Thailand you have this very pungent sort of fishy sauce, but I'll tell you what, that was nothing compared with the stinky tofu in Taiwan at the restaurant there, and people were talking about this specialist stinky tofu and how stinky and horrible it was. And I was thinking, oh, I don't mind, you know, I'll have whatever the local thing is, I'll have some, it doesn't matter. So I had some, and boy, was it revolting. It was really stinky. So I had to give up on that one, I admit. But for others, then that's the great delicacy, isn't it? Yeah, it's how we're conditioned. So greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, and delusion always operates in those spaces that we don't want to look at. So all those things that we don't want to see. Notice that. Notice when you turn away from things, when you're reluctant to listen to someone, when you don't want to know about something. The power of delusion is trying to keep our mind protected from knowledge, from information. One of the questions that was asked was today was about the difference between knowledge and wisdom. And of course, knowledge being something which is more quantifiable and discreet and particular. And so, you know, you get knowledge about particular things or certain situations. Or is wisdom being something which is much more general? Wisdom, in a sense, manifests in terms of a... Wisdom needs knowledge. So it needs information. It needs data to work on. But wisdom needs space, and so this, I think, is the very important thing. And this is what we get through our meditation and our contemplative space, and that gives us time to digest knowledge more profoundly, to digest it and to assimilate it, and then it can become wisdom. And so wisdom doesn't apply to a particular time or place or thing, but is much more in terms of an orientation or a perspective that allows to see things within their a context that gives them meaning. So when we when our wisdom is weak and our wisdom is struggling, then in a sense there's a sense of fear about it. It feels threatened. And so because it has a sense of identity, it has a sense of ideas and views around itself which it won't, which it feels happy with, it's attached to and identifies with. And so, for example, our ideas about religion, our ideas about Dhamma, and this is something that's very important, because we come to Buddhism in order to let go, in order to for the mind to be open, in order to not suffer. But we very quickly get very, very attached to Buddhism and to Buddhist ideas. And so this is why within Buddhism we have conflict and we argue with each other about interpretations of Dhamma things, or we argue about bhikkhunis or something like that, because we become so attached to the forms and the externalities of Buddhism. And this, I think, is a very, very subtle but very powerful form of delusion. And it's something which we need, especially as people who are interested to live a spiritual life deeply and to commit ourselves fully to a Buddhist practice. We need to make this very, very conscious of how we do this. Because otherwise we're going to get in exactly the same situation that we've seen emerging around the bhikkhuni ordination, where the attachment to some idea of a tradition or of a way it's been done and so on completely obscures common human decency, and because it's the common ability to be able to accept that, well, we should give people a fair go. It's a basic ethical truth which any of us can be aware of and can know. It's just almost like a, you know, it's almost like it's an a priori truth. It's just so obvious that people shouldn't be discriminated against. And yet, because of our attachment to the tradition, our inability to see things from another perspective, then we can't get over these things. And it's for me very painful, because it then severely limits the amount of good and the benefit that can be derived from this Buddhist practice. So we will be in that same place, and I'm sure we already have been, and we probably are now, and we will be in the future. So it's not something to be externalizing and to be blaming. We are ourselves in this same situation. So this is why we have to be very fearless in looking in ourselves and looking at our own problems and our own issues. And especially to emphasize this idea of the attachment to Buddhism and the attachment to Dhamma, to recognize and have the humility that, well, it's just a way of seeing the world. Right view is just a view. And we don't do this practice in order to become narrow-minded and bigoted. We don't do it in order to think that we're superior to others because we've got better knowledge than others. We don't do it in order that we can prove how much better Buddhism is as a religion than any other religion. We only do it because it is useful and helps us on that path to freedom from suffering. And if it is simply creating more suffering, then it's not doing its job. We should just abandon it, get rid of it. That's all that it's useful for. It's just there to help us to get rid of greed, hatred and delusion. That's what the Dhamma is there for. So this is my little talk for you this evening on greed, hatred and delusion. So I offer this to you for your reflection, and hopefully hasn't made you too angry or deluded. A little bit angry is all right, and we maybe have some good questions. But anyway, are there any questions or comments?